From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. This week's guest is Jian Baek, who is a PhD candidate in public policy at the University of Oxford and was previously a research fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University. And she's here to talk about her new book and her research about getting information into North Korea and the possible effects that information could have on this notoriously reclusive regime. So Jian, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So people may have a perception that North Korea is completely closed off, that there's no information about the outside world getting in, and that North Koreans are totally brainwashed only to believe what the regime lets them believe. And while it's true that they have a lot less information than we do here, there is some information that gets in. So can you set the stage for our listeners a little bit here? What is it like? What kind of information is getting through to the DPRK?
Sure. So I think it's important to note that access or consumption or circulation of any unauthorized information and media is highly punishable in North Korea. I think that's important to bear in mind. And we'll get more into that later. But with that stated, you know, despite these risks of high fines and sentences to detention centers and political camps and all this, there is a growing demand for foreign information and media inside North Korea. And so there are a lot of actors involved, outside NGOs, quasi-governmental organizations, as well as defector-led initiatives to push outside information into this country for anybody who is willing to accept the risks and consume some of this information. And that information ranges from entertainment to a more sensitive content like foreign news, political commentary, interviews with defectors, non-defector interviews, as well as a lot of like historical content.
How exactly does this information get into North Korea, especially given that they are pretty worried about some of this information getting to the people?
Sure. So it is, from my observations, it does operate on pretty basic supply and demand principles. And so where there's a demand, there's a supply. This applies to, you know, most contexts. In North Korea, with the just increased scale of grassroots marketization over the past two or three decades, this marketization of this country has been married with just a growing demand for outside information. And so there's a network of NGOs and other organizations that are driven by goodwill and more, you know, kind of principles of freedom and all this. They create and curate content, put them in storage devices, or maybe push them through radio programs. And then another group of actors, basically middlemen who make a commission, who make money off of bringing these USBs, these SD chips, sometimes DVDs, into the country, they will then be in charge of physically pushing this content into this country. And then these goods get distributed inside markets in very local contexts across the country. And then consumers will purchase them. So every stage of what I just described is against the North Korean government's will. But it does happen because there's demand inside the country. And so once they're bought off of the market, then people will start to circulate, loan them out, share them with trusted friends and family. And so that's how the goods get pushed in from Seoul and China into different parts of North Korea. In addition to information that's put onto storage devices, so SD chips, micro SD chips, DVDs, there are radio broadcasts from all over. So VOA and Radio Free Asia, for example, that's based out of the United States, where you are in Washington, D.C. There's various South Korean programs that are broadcast into North Korea. And then BBC also recently announced that they will expand their world service program to cover the Korean Peninsula, which is good news for anybody who is a champion of this issue. And then there's also smaller South Korea-based radio programs that are led by activists as well as a lot of defectors that create content and that broadcast them into North Korea. And of course, the old method of airborne leaflets, very, you know, it's low and high tech airborne leaflets. That's been a technique that's been used in the Korean Peninsula context since the Korean War. Both sides sent airborne leaflets across the DMZ. And this method of sending information into North Korea continues today.
Yeah, it's. I'm glad you mentioned the BBC, because that was really interesting that they're just now getting into this game. But at the same time, they must be seeing something that is prompting them to do that, or they must be seeing a utility for that. You know, I think they've been thinking about this for a long time, and now they're going to start broadcasting in Korean. So that's a good sign, I think.
Right. I can't agree with you more.
I'm really interested in how exactly it works between, you know, you are a North Korean person and you have access to some sort of outside information, and then somehow that shifts your perception, or somehow that changes how you believe about your world. That's the idea anyway of how this Sure. is changing North Korea. So can you talk a little bit more about that? And I also found it really interesting because you recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, and you specifically compare it to the Cold War and how information programs such as VOA or Radio Free Europe were used to undermine the Soviet regime. So can you talk a little bit more in like this theoretical perspective of how does the information go about changing someone's mind about something?
Sure. So there are so many ways to label or frame this issue. Some people could call it information campaigns, information warfare, information operations, psychological warfare, a war on ideas. And there's, if you go into the theory and the more academic literature on it, there's very specific ways to talk about this. But just for our conversation today, this phenomenon of trying to fight ideologies has been taking place for as long as mankind has existed. And in the Cold War context, in addition to the containment strategy, the United States government sponsored information campaigns, sometimes on their own, sometimes with anti-Soviet dissidents inside the country, as well as those who escaped the Soviet Union. They worked to push information into the Soviet Union with the goal of undermining its ideologies. There were many parts of the strategy, but two of the big pillars of these strategies comprise, number one, undermining people's belief that communism was a superior form of governance, and number two, undermining the Soviet teaching that a centrally commanded economy in the communist context was not only superior but sustainable. And so a lot of information campaigns were curated and implemented in a way to undermine those two main pillars of Soviet ideology as they were taught to the citizens. There were radio programs, there were writings and literature and research that was encouraged and funded by parts of the U.S. government to enhance conversations and literature that would go head-to-head with the Soviet communist ideology. And there's so much that's been written and researched on this subject of the Cold War era ideological warfare. And this went both ways, of course. Soviets were masters at trying to fight ideologies that were not friendly to theirs. And so this is an era that a lot of writing and research has been taking place. And so I think there's lessons to be learned from this context that can then be applied to North Korea and other contexts, but especially today, for today's conversation, could definitely be applied to North Korea. So not only the U.S. government, but other interested governments, as well as private citizens and NGOs, faith-based organizations, could turn to this Cold War era to learn what worked and what didn't work in that context, to then localize it into the North Korean context. And in terms of the other question you raised about how does this really work, and there's no linear path, there's no one linear model of how foreign information then changes someone's mind in XYZ sequence and then leads to some magical outcome. I wish it did, but of course, you know, the people that are listening to this are just that. They're people, and everyone responds in a different way, in oftentimes unpredictable ways. But from my both primary and secondary research, what I've come across is almost every single person I have spoken with personally over the past decade or longer has told me that having access to information from the outside, having repeated exposure to information from the outside world through the form of movies, news, etc., definitely triggered questions and skepticism in their country, and really enhanced cognitive tension, cognitive dissonance in their minds, sparked a lot of questions. But information alone was not sufficient to convince a North Korean citizen to defect or take some other dramatic action to change their livelihood inside this country. And that's important to note because defection, as you know, is punishable by death. People are not authorized to leave the country without explicit government permission. And so defection is people's absolute last resort when they have no other means to survive, whether it's for economic reasons or political reasons. So then that, if I were to kind of generalize this process, I would say that having repeat exposure to foreign information is a necessary but not a sufficient factor in convincing individuals or at a collective level to make some dramatic change in their life.
Right, that's really interesting. I think myself, having done a lot of reading or done a lot of research about North Korea and also about the possibilities with some of these information campaigns, you see in a lot of cases they'll interview defectors and they'll say, I defected after watching XYZ movie and realizing something about the outside world. So it is good to keep in perspective that it can have an influencing effect, but it's not a silver bullet here that we should be only relying on.
Right. I agree with you. And like I mentioned, North Koreans are just, you know, they're people. And so people respond to the same trigger or same kind of shock factor in different ways. And so if some people may have thought that accessing a foreign movie or something like that kind of tipped them over the edge or just enhanced whatever doubt that they are already feeling. But in my limited research, what I found is that that's often not the case. It's a combination of factors that lead people to make dramatic changes to their life.
You mentioned this briefly earlier, but accessing this type of information is illegal for North Koreans, and they can be punished quite severely. So can you get a little bit more into that? What exactly happens to someone if they are caught watching this type of illicit information? And what kind of techniques are people using to avoid getting caught?
Sure. So sentences to detention centers, labor camps, and political prison camps are, that's for starters, that's one major category of consequence that people can and do face for having access to unauthorized media. And in worst cases, public executions do continue to take place. But because this phenomenon is so rampant and local authorities, you know, they're really unable to sentence or kill everybody who's caught committing this crime, this information crime, bribes have really taken an increasing role in enabling citizens to get out of sticky situations. I think more often than not, people are bribing their way out of situations when they're caught. And this speaks to a kind of a larger and somewhat separate phenomenon in North Korea, which is the explosion of corruption and how bribes, now that North Koreans depend on the markets and people now have access to more cash, bribes do enable citizens to get away with more things than they would otherwise maybe a decade or two ago. But those are the major consequences, high fines, which then sort of go hand in hand with bribes, sentences to detention centers, labor camps, political prison camps, and for worst case scenarios, they do include public execution. And so, like you mentioned, what are people doing to avoid being caught? So there is this constant cat and mouse game where the regime and the citizens, along with their contacts outside of North Korea, are constantly trying to outsmart each other. A long time ago, maybe two or three decades ago, VHS tapes were popular not only in the rest of the world, but inside North Korea. But they're too clunky, they're too heavy and big to conceal and move around in a stealth way. And so then DVDs came in vogue. They were easy to conceal and etc. But then the government got really smart and implemented these inspections where they would turn off the electricity in maybe an apartment building or a village and then go door to door and then ask to see DVD players because people would then be unable to press eject button to hide the DVD. And then the people who are consuming illegal media on DVDs in trouble. So then this word spread to outsiders, to outside organizations. And so then outside organizations started to send in USBs because they're easier to conceal. And then micro SD chips because they're even more easy to conceal. And more importantly, they're easy to destroy if necessary. So in addition to bribing their way out, people are working with outside organizations and just really brainstorming and engaging clever methods to avoid being caught by engaging in different types of technologies to continue learning about the outside world.
So I'm really interested. You did a lot of interviews with North Korean defectors for your book and talked to them about their lives, the role that outside information had on their lives while they were in the DPRK. So are there any interesting trends or interesting stories that really stuck with you as you were doing your research?
Sure. I mentioned earlier briefly, but this idea that information alone did not convince the people I spoke with to defect. I've spoken with many people from North Korea from different classes, different regions, and almost everyone told me that information alone did not convince them to defect. But having repeat exposure to information did increase tension and cognitive dissonance and the type of questions that they were forced to grapple with on their own as they were mentally fighting different realities that they were living in. It adds a more nuanced narrative, a nuanced observation in this whole phenomenon of North Koreans accessing information and what impact that's having. So that's something that was somewhat of a counterintuitive finding that I came across a while ago that I can't emphasize enough for the listener. And in terms of an interesting story, there's a really humanizing story I'd like to share, where his name is Kwang Song. He's a friend from Paejong. That's really a really northeastern city in North Korea. And he was telling me about the first time he watched a movie when he was in middle school with a classmate. And then he ended up asking his parents for a DVD player, and he just watched a lot of movies before he ended up leaving. And he left for other kind of more sensitive reasons. But he told me that when he was watching these films, he really wanted to go to two places. Number one, he really wanted to go to Jeju Island, which is, I might be getting this analogy wrong, but sort of like the Hawaii of South Korea. And then the other location he really wanted to go to was Las Vegas, because he was watching this movie about, and it was located in Vegas. And he just thought everyone was so, the lights were so bright and people were so happy and all this. So I asked him, did that extreme desire for you to see these two places, Jeju-do and Las Vegas, did that want you to defect in any small way? And he said, absolutely not. My family is in Hwaneong, and envy or wishful thinking is one thing. I want to be a millionaire. I want to marry a supermodel. I want to become an astronaut and all these things. But he said, wishful thinking stopped at when I turned off the movies. And real life set in. I had to do my chores. I had to take care of my sister and help my parents. Had to go to re-education, lecture, self-criticism sessions, and all these things. And so then he ended up defecting. And he ended up going to both locations in Jeju Island and Las Vegas on two separate occasions. And he told me that he just had such an extreme, an overwhelming embodiment of what freedom means. Being able to stand in the place that the movie that he watched under blankets and covers in North Korea out of fear of being caught, he was able to stand in that movie location. And he thought, wow, there's nothing that a human being cannot accomplish. And so that was a really beautiful story that I thought that really humanizes this whole research and phenomenon for myself. And if you want to learn more about Kwang Song's story, you can definitely check out the book. I'll leave it there.
So I think this fits in well, your story about humanizing or keeping the North Korean issue in perspective and talking about North Korean people like they're just people too. And a few weeks ago, I actually did an interview for this podcast on the topic of breaking stereotypes about North Korea and writing accurately about the DPRK. The guest was Jean Lee, who was a reporter both in Seoul and Pyongyang for a long time. So first of all, I'm really curious to hear your perspective. And I also know that you have recently written an article debunking various myths that people have about North Korea. So I have two questions. Number one,
sure.
Can you give us a couple of examples of the most prevalent myths or the ones that really drive you crazy? And as a researcher, do you actively try to address some of those stereotypes and misperceptions that your audience might have when they're reading your work?
One, maybe it's a myth, maybe it's sort of people's emotional reactions when coming across North Koreans. But an observation that I've made, not just as a researcher, but as a Korean-American, as a Christian, as a woman, I've noted that so many well-meaning people, they tend to view North Korean defectors as pure victims. And so I think what that materializes in, this attitude of North Korean people being all just these pure victims, is that it leads often to North Korean defectors being glorified and having their tragedies really romanticized. And I recognize that it comes from a good place. But the reason why I kind of want to add more nuance to people's identities, the North Korean people's identities, is that they're so much more than a defector, someone who has escaped from their harrowing country of birth. They're so much more than their defection story and all this. They're just like me and you and the listener. They're complicated. Sometimes some people are simple, but oftentimes they're very complicated, multidimensional people with various identities. Not only are they a defector, but they also have different roles. Maybe they're a mother, they're a sister, they're a teacher, they're all these things. And I think it's just important to bear in mind that North Korean people, not just the defectors, but the citizens inside this country, are very multidimensional people. And when I see articles about North Koreans being brainwashed people who don't know anything about the outside world, that drives me insane. Because yes, they are subject to constant propaganda, constant political education, or some people could call that brainwashing. That's fine, but as we see, not only with the influx of information, but the really wide-scale nature of grassroots markets and a lot of exposure to trading with Chinese people and all these things, they're not as unaware of the outside world as they may have been 20, 30 years ago, or how the media paints them today. Much more dimensional. And I think the supermajority of defectors, they've experienced unbelievably difficult lives. That's something that we cannot underestimate. And the human rights situation in this country must be part of every conversation about North Korea, I believe. But the defectors who have gone through harrowing experiences, again, it's a supermajority of people who defected, they need people's help and resources and assistance in adjusting to new lives out of North Korea. And they deserve compassion, but absolutely not pity. And they deserve to be treated with respect and dignity and not as charity cases. I think the narrative that often frames defectors as individuals and as somewhat of this constructed demographic, it really, I think, takes away a lot of agency and autonomy and pride that individuals have. And I just really hope that listeners who want to just be more, just kind of learn more about this world of North Korea and all this, could really inject more nuance and a more kind of a human-centered attitude when thinking about and engaging with North Koreans. And of course, this is all to say it's essential to separate the regime and the citizens, but that's something that I would want to underscore.
All right, so we've talked about a lot of really important and interesting issues here. I do want to give you a chance before we sign off. Is there anything else that you think people should know about your research or about North Korea in general?
Sure. I think there's so much good work being done in this space, not just in the research realm, but organizations. And I encourage anyone who is interested in learning more to be critical of the sources that we all come across and read about, but also to give attention to individuals and researchers and NGOs who may be a little bit under the radar. If they want to be under the radar, then yes, please respect their privacy. But for the individuals who may not have a flashy website or a flashy CV or maybe a defect organization that they don't have some perfect brochure, just continue to give attention to such organizations and research that's being done by such entities. And one thing I will end on here is that I do want to inform the audience that profits from book sales, I will donate to small organizations that send information into North Korea. So I hope that some of you will have the opportunity to pick up a copy or two and learn more about not just the research, but a lot of the voices of the people involved in this work.
That's all for this episode of Korean Context. I really want to thank Jian Baek for taking her time to come and talk about her research. I want to emphasize that the book is called North Korea's Hidden Revolution: How the Information Underground is Transforming a Closed Society, and it's available now from Yale University Press. Thank you again for joining us here on the podcast, and we'll see you again next week with another great episode.